Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice. I'm in.
Hello and welcome to episode 117 of Signal of Doom. I'm Dave. I'm here without the main man, Stu. Now, first off, I can imagine the surprise reeling in it. Stu is on heavy secret Avengers business, and that's why he's not here today. And I hear some people out there saying, what's with the solo albums, guys? Like, you're just dropping solo albums left, right, and center. Well, this is mid-66, 1966, Bob Dylan. You know, the duets is off for the night, and I rolled into the studio and I said to the guys, to the engineers, we're going to record a long one, and this one's on me, okay? Because I feel I owe the signal and owe the listeners for my absence. And, yeah, look, Stu will be back next week, and we're looking forward to having him back as always. Stu is a major part of the signal. Now, what are we doing in trade this week? We're doing the original Clone Saga, and we're doing the first half of that because, as Dave found out and Stu found out, I thought original Clone Saga would be like back in the old days, three or four issues, and I was like, yeah, this will be easy. I opened up on my iPad, 400 and how many? I'm looking at it now, 493 or something pages, and I was like, Jesus Christ, like, where did this come from? 496 pages for what I felt was going to be a quick read. So I said to Stu, because, you know, I'll get to the review later in the show, but, like, I'm enjoying it. And I said, why don't we just split it into two halves? And Stu was amenable to that idea. And so we're going to cover up until the end of issue 148, which is pretty much halfway in this massive trade. And then not next week. We're doing Dark Phoenix Saga next week, and then the week after that we'll finish off Clone Saga. So I'll do a bit of a recap of the first half this episode, and that'll give everyone, if you feel interested, because it is good, more time to go and read that one. Now, okay, so what's Dave been up to? Well, you know, I've come off the illness, and I have that thing now where you've come off an illness and you feel like you've got a lot of energy, and probably you think you've got a bit more than you do, but I've been having a good time. Been playing a bit of Injustice 2, the DC fighting game. Just a really, like, I have a thing, I like fighting games. I know that they seem really simplistic and stuff, but I actually enjoy them, and just the amount of options you have in these games and the stuff they come out with. Like, if I was a lot younger and had more friends who played this kind of stuff, I'd be fucking heavy into it. Like, I've just been playing it at night pretty much before bed. Just, you know, quick 20, 30 minute spin around with some of the characters. It really is a lot of fun, that game. But the big news for me this week was I have been hardcore waiting for this. Bob Dylan releasing a 14-disc compact disc set, or CDs, whatever you call them, like 14 discs worth of material from the mid-70s, the Rolling Thunder review, and I have been waiting for this for like the last 2 weeks. And I got it all digitally, and yeah, I just literally this morning first thing was like had bought it, started listening. I've only listened to the first album so far, and it's just awesome. Like, Rolling Thunder review is when Bob pulled together a lot of players and played basically small theaters in the States, and just I think toured for like a year or something with sort of the Rolling Thunder review, they were called, and he made a movie and all this kind of stuff around it. And on June 12th there's a companion documentary directed by Martin Scorsese about the tour, so I'm fucking can't wait for that. But in the meantime, yeah, I've just been just kicking back in the old chair. Like, if I was in the 90s, I'd say smoke a fat one, guys, you know, and just fucking enjoy it. Like, you don't need to be stoned to enjoy it, but, like, just enjoy it, just to savor in it. It's always a pleasure for me with Bob Dylan. Like, any album that comes out, I mean, they come out less frequently these days, but even still, like, when he put out, like, Tempest, I love that feeling of, like, just locking myself away in the dark, just put it on and just relax and just let the master take you on a journey. And, I mean, this disc set is from when he was at his peak. Like, he peaked in the mid-60s and he peaked again in the mid-70s in terms of what he's doing. And, yeah, it's just going to be capture a real moment. I can't wait to – there's live shows and everything. So it's called Bob Dylan Rolling Thunder Review, I think, R-E-V-U-E. Easy to find. And they'll generally they put out a smaller, like a two-disc sampler as well, like But I bought the full thing. Now, I also want to mention upcoming the main man's little companion, Dion, my buddy, is going to be making an appearance. He did do one appearance early on in the show. He's going to come on in the next couple of weeks with Stu and me and do an episode. We've picked the trade, American Vampire. So that'll be coming down the pipe. The little guy knows nothing about comics. But he thinks he does, which is what makes it more fun. So we'll have him on. And just wrapping up on the personal, gee, what a personal tale it is. Okay, I started to make some fucking moves. Okay, one, I embraced audiobooks and I'm currently listening to The Stand. So that puts me on fucking notch one. I picked up two collections of Uncanny X-Force and I've purchasing the Blackest Night Omnibus for Green Lantern. And shout out to Jimmy Terzis, by the way, from Eric and Jimmy Rule the Galaxy. Thank you for the shout out you gave me, guys. And back at you, two of my favorite guys and one of the best podcasts I listen to and the best Star Wars podcast that I listen to. They're shooting straight from the fucking hip. That's the thing. They're shooting from the hip and they're fucking finding targets. And that's exactly what I like. And that's what I try to do on Signal. Yeah, and I just dig their intensity. And, like, one of the funniest fucking things I've ever seen was Jimmy pointed me to it. Basically, everyone knows I listen to a lot of Collider. Well, I'm fucking off Collider because I've just realized that, like, so much of the time it's just fucking endless hype. And then the movie comes out and you realize, wow, you guys have been hyping this for fucking a year. I didn't need so much hype. But anyway, one of the guys there, Christian Harlov, and I don't mind him, like, in general, but he Galaxy's Edge, the Star Wars theme park, is opening in Anaheim or wherever the fuck it's opening. We've covered it on the show before. They've got two locations at both Disneylands, I think, Disneyland and Disney World. I don't know which one he's having a cry about, but basically they invited press there. They didn't invite him. And in fairness, I will say that Star Wars Jedi Council, I mean, it got me back into, like, sort of appreciating Star Wars a bit more, but anyway, he had a big fucking cry about not being invited online, like on the show. Like, honestly, have some level of dignity, please. Like, you're not doing anything the Signal's not... Like, yeah, you're fucking hyping, but you're not doing anything that the Signal's not doing or that fucking Jimmy Terzis is not doing. Like, we're all fucking putting shit out there, like pumping it up, like this pop culture stuff. Like, I don't see Bob Iger flying me over, like, you know... I'm a beck and call, and neither should he. Like, although I'm available, Bob. I don't know. Just have some level of dignity. I mean, he was having, oh, I burst my ass doing this. You're sitting in a fucking studio, getting paid more than you probably fucking should. Just hyping shit. Like, give me a break. Like, Jimmy Terzis and Eric analysis is about a billion times more interesting. Yeah, I'm off it, man. I'm off it big. You lost me, and then you lost me again. Like, Jesus Christ. And, you know, I'm always available for sponsorships and stuff, but, like, I'm not going to fucking have an open-air cry about it. Like, my God. Just some people, you know, really, the level of entitlement is high, is all I can say. And they're surrounded by yes men. Oh, yeah, yeah, wow, great point. Another zinger. No, not a zinger. Probably one of the more woeful moments on the internet that I've seen in the last 12 months. Look, I've got a thing here because before I thought Stu was going to, you know, before I knew he was not going to be available this show, I had box office discussion because we all know Stu loves to do box office discussion. Jesus Christ. Like, I mean, it's almost pull out the fucking PowerPoint presentation when he starts going in. And to be honest, my attention starts wavering big time. Like, I'm not getting a percentage from the box office take and hence I only have so much interest in it. It's true. I mean, honestly, like, it is interesting to discuss it, but, like, at a certain point, like, I'm not a shareholder. I fucking should be. I should fucking buy into Warner's or something. I should become a shareholder. I should do something like, I seriously should. You know, maybe when the world ends, their stock will be high and I can cash out. Okay, so I've got here box office discussion, Godzilla numbers. Well, okay, I'm looking at Box Office Mojo now. The domestic total of Godzilla is 60 million. And foreign is 130, pushing into 190. Now, it says production budget of 170. I haven't seen this movie, and I've heard that it's very much a throwback to the classic sort of 60s-style, kind of Japanese-style Godzilla. And I say good, because I didn't like the Godzilla they did in the 90s, and I certainly didn't like the more recent one they did a few years ago where I didn't feel like you saw enough Godzilla. I think this is the opposite. I think they're going real heavy on the monsters in this one, and I think that's their audience, frankly, and you might as well chase that audience, like see how big it is. Aladdin, I haven't seen Aladdin yet, but I really do want to see it. I think I was talking to Michelle the other night and we were saying Aladdin, yes or no, and she's kind of like, yeah. Right, currently 203 million domestic, 293 foreign for almost 500 million, just under 500 million. I mean, that to me seems like a huge success. And I still do, I do want to see this. I really want to see as well, just come out in Australia, I think today, Dark Phoenix. Now, I know the reviews aren't great, but I don't really give a fuck. My expectations aren't extremely high. I hope it's better than Apocalypse, which I found Apocalypse disappointing. I went in with high expectations. As always, we know what the critics have said. Okay, fine. I can table that to one side. I'll go in with an open mind. Stu and I will both watch this over the weekend. It's a long weekend here in Australia. And so next show, we'll have a full Dark Phoenix discussion and potentially an Aladdin one if I get to see that as well. And we'll also do Dark Phoenix Saga, the classic like 70s story from X-Men in that show as well. So that'll be a Dark Phoenix-centric episode. I've actually got a Grant Morrison Grant Morrison Phoenix story on my iPad, which I might try to read just to get a bit more Phoenix in my lifetime. Now, turning to my next news item here, Dave the Journalist struck again. I mean, we all remember the fiasco over the non-crediting of Roger Stern on that Avengers Forever omnibus, which I cracked open that case. Well, I was back at it again. I was just sitting here kind of, you know, just kind of rolling and just kind of thinking, thoughts were coming. And as always, I've said on the show so many times, where's the Wolverine solo fucking title? And I was just sitting here and I thought, I'm going to ask CB Sabalski. I'm going to go to the editor-in-chief of Marvel. And I tweeted him and said, you know, hi CB, just checking in on when there will be a Wolverine solo title, asking on behalf of many Signal of Doom listeners. Always give the podcast a bit of a plug. And and we need him, I said. Okay, put that out there, sort of semi-forgot about it for an hour or two. And probably at about the hour mark, CB Sabalski tweeted back with wait and see and schnicked, like the symbol for Wolverine and sort of like the claws kind of symbol. And I was kind of like, wow, I mean, okay, I haven't broken open Watergate, I admit it, okay. But like, I've done something. I've asked some fucking questions and got some answers. Like, I didn't get like, oh, one day in the future, maybe we'll, you know, fucking do it. Like, oh, yeah, if all the stars align. Wait and see. We know Jonathan Hickman's coming onto X-Men. I saw some fucking article they're going to change the name of X-Men. Like, please don't. Like, Jesus Christ. Because you've got so much fucking goodwill and brand recognition on the title X-Men. Do not change it, Jonathan Hickman, please. Like, write great stories, but just don't change the fucking title of the X-Men. Please keep that as the group name. That is not a sexist comment. That is just because I don't think the brand needs any more watering down. The fucking Disney have done enough watering down of the franchise while Fox owned the film rights. We need to get back to basics on X-Men, big time. And I am looking very forward to what Jonathan Hickman does, by the way. I think his run on Fantastic Four was amongst the best comics I've ever read. I wasn't that big a Fantastic Four fan either, but I loved that run. And I thought his Avengers run was very interesting. I didn't enjoy it as much. But I thought that Fantastic Four run was awesome. And his Avengers is pretty awesome too. It just wasn't more my cup of tea at certain points. Although I did keep reading. I read the whole thing. Okay, so, well, I guess that covers it for Dave the Journalist. There wasn't too much else popping off, like, you know, political scandals were taking a back seat this week. Then we had, this is really for Stu, Magic the Gathering, the Russo brothers, obviously of, you know, Endgame, Winter Soldier, etc., Infinity War fame, and Netflix are conjuring up an animated series. This is interesting. Like, I know sort of secondhand how big Magic the Gathering is. I believe Stu plays it, actually. So this is something that I'm sure he would be interested in, a Netflix animated show. Kind of surprised it hasn't happened already. So, yeah, I know they put out a... because Magic the Gathering own the rights to Dungeons & Dragons, and they put out a compendium, you know, D&D with the Magic the Gathering characters. I've never played it myself, to be honest. So I assume it's quite similar to, like, a Gwent game that I play in... in Witcher. I think it's that kind of thing. Obviously, there's a lot of fans out there, and they do very well, which is cool. I mean, I remember in the 90s when people were playing it. It just seemed like it was like a... It seemed like it was a lot of cash to really get involved. And at the time, I was spending my money on, you know, comics, basically. And, yeah, I just kind of sidetracked it. Now, this is actually cool. Liz Hurley is playing Morgan Le Fay in Runaway Season 3. I love Liz Hurley. I think I always thought she was really quite hot, like, and funny. I've always quite liked Liz Hurley. She's playing Morgan Le Fay, and there's a description of the character, in case you don't know. I mean, we know her from the Arthurian Legends, I believe. Described as an iconic villain from Marvel Comics, Morgan Le Fay is a student of Merlin, and as such is considered the greatest sorceress of all time. With a black crow as her familiar and the ability to, 1, enchant objects, 2, manipulate mystic energy, and 3, astral project, she's powerful and intelligent while also wielding a cutthroat wit. Yeah, I think Liz Hurley would be fantastic in a role like this. More power to her. And I always like Liz Hurley. I think she's quite funny. Okay, this is interesting. There's potentially this is a news item that I plucked out, and notice that all my news items are coming in this week because no Stu to like edit it out. Django Unchained and a Zorro movie, like a team up movie, is apparently on the way. Tarantino is apparently attached, but his exact role is unclear. Now we do know that he's obviously got Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And he's still attached to this Star Trek movie, although there's not many details released. I'll be surprised if Tarantino isn't an original series guy. He just strikes me as it would be original series, but I could be wrong. Maybe he's a next-gen guy. But whatever, he's got that attached. This is more curious to me. So, and there's no announcements if Jamie Foxx is, you know, playing Django. Or who's playing Zorro. I assume it won't be Antonio Banderas. I don't know. Like, interesting. And there was a comic of this, apparently. Django Unchained and Zorro had a comic. Maybe it was from Dynamite or someone like that. I never read it. I'm not too hot on those kind of, like, movie adaption team-ups. That's where I feel a bit like... I sometimes wish I was a bit more sort of... inquisitive, because I see that, like, Django Unchained and Zorro have done a comic together. I'd like to know where listeners are on that, because for me, I'm always like, yeah, it sounds like you're really trying to just spin it now. Like, whereas maybe sometimes it's good, but I always think, yeah, do we really need 2 70s TV shows to team up together in a comic? But maybe some people think it's the fucking hottest thing, you know, out there since sliced bread, so maybe, I don't know. Anyway, but Django Unchained Zorro movie, I'm more like, yeah, okay, show me the fucking film. But, like, don't half-ass it. I want a fucking good movie, you know. I quite like Django Unchained. It's not one of my favourite Tarantino movies, but I actually still think it's a very good film. I prefer quite a lot of his other films to that, but I still think it's a pretty damn good movie. I've only seen it twice. So it's almost due for a rewatch for me, because I do remember there were scenes that I really enjoyed. Anyway... quick RIP to Jeff Darrow of Blake 7 fame. Now, I'm not... and I would be surprised if there's too many Blake 7 fans of this podcast. It was very much a show that came and went while I was watching Doctor Who as a kid, as a young kid, and it was referenced a lot of Doctor Who supplementary material that they did around the time, because I think it was very much like a, you know, sort of a rival show. I know that Blake 7... is a show where the bad guys won, apparently, in the final episode. But anyway, I just want to do a quick RIP, because I know it was a much-loved show of the late 70s and 80s. The guy had passed away after a short illness. And I read that, like, about 2014, he had both his legs amputated as well. That's got to fucking suck. RIP to Jeff Darrow. Now, some sad news. The Sci-Fi Network cancelled Deadly Class, the Rick Remender comic that got turned into a show, and also Happy, the Grant Morrison show. Now, I am so bad. I really like Happy. I've not read Deadly Class much. I've read a couple of issues. But Happy I really liked. I've never watched it, so I'm part of the problem. Both Image Comics adaptations are currently looking for a new home, but I certainly hope they find it. I really enjoyed the Happy comic, what I read. I thought it was really kind of fucking novel, and I really like that guy from that was on Law and Order, Special Victims Unit, that plays the main guy in Happy. So he's a good actor. I like him a lot. I can't remember his name for the life of me at all. I actually have no idea what the guy's name is. Apologies. I've watched about hundreds of episodes of Law and Order SVU, though. Now, this is a kind of a feel-good story. Jim Lee, Tom King, and some DC CW stars made a surprise USO trip to Kuwait. Tom King, Jim Lee, Nafessa Williams, Candice Patton, and Daniela Panabaker, who I believe is the chick from Flash, returned today from a surprise trip to Kuwait as part of a special mission with the United Service Organizations USO. Done as part of DC's 80th anniversary of Batman celebration, the group took part in a multi-day tour of Kuwait, visiting a nearby 12,000 US military member stationed in the Middle Eastern country. Well, that's good to see, and I do like people who support the troops, and I do like that when the celebrities go over there and do that. I think it's a very important function, and I'm just glad to see that that is still happening. You know, a lot of these military people read comics, actually. You know, it's quite common in the military to be reading comics and stuff like that, from what I'm aware of. And people send over packages and stuff. I mean, they're stationed a long way from home in treacherous conditions. So shout out to those guys. Now, this is interesting. Harrison Ford says that Indiana Jones, what number is it? 5, I guess, will start production in 2020. The Variety also reports that Spielberg is currently working on the West Side Story remake. And I've got a question to Stu. Do you think we'll see this in like 2020-21? I mean, Harrison's ain't getting any younger, so they better get something moving on it. Look, we all know Harrison gets a lot more money out of the Indiana Jones deal. And he wasn't very open to other people playing the role. I don't really blame him. I just hope they do it. And I didn't hate Crystal Skull as much as some people, but I certainly didn't think it was that good. I just wish they'd make it. Let's get this thing done. I actually really kind of enjoy Indiana Jones in general. I think he's a really fucking cool character, and the movies are really cool. Now, this is a vague one, and shout out to the guys at Into the Night. Marvel confirms, and that's where I have the question mark. Marvel confirms Moon Knight is in the MCU's near future. I thought this was a vague report. I looked at what Feige said. He very much did the old, one day down the track, we might look at that. You know, that's what it seemed like to me. I'm interested in hearing Ray and Connor, where they are on it. They're the Moon Knight guys. They're the ones on the fucking beat all the time. They're working the streets trying to get leads on this fucking Moon Knight stuff. I hope it happens, frankly. I think Moon Knight as a TV show, we could play with the personality disorders and stuff like that. Could be really fascinating. Why not? Some people will get offended, I'm sure, because, it's a sensitive topic and stuff. But, hey, people get offended no matter what. People would listen to this show and get offended, and my reaction is, I don't fucking care. You know what I mean? Let's get this Moon Knight going. And I've pitched it before, and I'll pitch it again. Marvel Knights, Moon Knight, Punisher, Ghost Rider, together. Oh, who's that? Blade. Oh, yeah. Could you imagine it? These four fucking characters going at it in a show. You can maybe make it three, but Moon Knight is a cool character. He's a good hand-to-hand fighter. He's got the whole multiple personalities thing. He's got a mystical component. I think Moon Knight ticks a lot of boxes as what could be a very interesting show. I prefer a show to a movie, frankly. Because I think you have more room to explore. That's what I personally think. And I don't think it needs to be the biggest budget thing of all time either. I think Moon Knight has a lot of angles. And I think probably that could be part of the problem with him. You've got to decide, are you going mystical? What are you going to do with the multiple personalities? You know, you can't ignore them. I'm definitely down for that. Adam Pine called for another 4 hours of power and said he could listen to Signal of Doom all day. Well, Adam, out of the computer is normally my favorite Adam, but this guy's come in with these kind of comments and he's blowing it wide open. Yeah, well, thank you, Adam, for that. I appreciate that. Now, Adam the computer, though, has fired off an email of his own. Maybe he knew that another Adam was stalking around in the message boards and he thought, it's time to flick across an email. I'm going to read it out. It's called DC Comics Shuffle from Adam the Computer Crouch. I've been kind of disappointed lately with the direction of the DC Universe. Despite a great stable of creators, the comics just don't excite me. It's the Sigil were in charge. I like the sound of this. What do you think some of these creators should be working on? Oh, okay. What kind of stories would you tell? Oh, this is a hard email, I see now. Jesus, like, okay, I'm in charge of DC. Bendis? Oh, God. I feel like Bendis is already doing all this shit, and he's already shitting out his average-level Bendis shit. I don't know. Like, that's hard. I almost would have Bendis on Superman, frankly, because I think his kind of soap opera style probably lends itself towards that. I actually think they probably made the right call there. A lot of people say Bendis on Batman, and I'd certainly check it out, and I reckon he would probably do an okay job. But it's been a long time since Bendis really performed on street level. Like, when I was getting back into comics, his Ultimate Spider-Man was one of the things that got me back into comics, and I loved it. But that was heavy on the soap opera. His Daredevil, I've not read heavily. I picked up Daredevil when Brubaker took over right at the end of Bendis' run. I'd probably have Bendis on Superman as he's doing and on all that shitty kind of teen stuff that he pubs out through Young Justice. I actually think they've got Bendis in the right place. I'm not particularly interested in it, but I think that is a good fit. Johns, well, Jeff Johns, clearly a guy with one foot in movies and one foot in comics still. I've done a turnaround on Doomsday Clock, and we're going to cover it later this week. I would have Jeff Johns on, like, Legion of Superheroes. And I only say that because he's already done Justice Society so well. But if I could have Johns on anything, it would be on Justice Society of America and Legion. And I particularly think Legion, because I trust Jeff Johns when he's left to his own devices. I think Jeff Johns, more often than not, has hit a home run. Whereas Bendis, he hits a lot of singles or to second base at best. Like, I think Jeff Johns hits a lot more home runs than most other mainstream creators. Tom King, I would take Tom King off Batman, not because I just think he wasn't ready for it, or he doesn't work well with others enough, and he doesn't understand the characters enough. I would have Tom King potentially doing, like, stuff like Mr. Miracle. I'd have him on sort of more kind of experimental books. I'd take him off the main characters. I could even I don't know what Tom King's interests are, but perhaps even a Superman title. Or give him a Flash or something. Give him something that's not Batman, because I don't think he understood Batman. And frankly, I'd want to sit down with him and just find out what he wants to do as well. Like, you know, that's the kind of thing where I think you need to hear from him, because I think the fans have spoken on his Batman and how disappointed they were after issue 50. That was a mistake, you know, on his behalf, and probably on editorial's behalf. And Heroes in Crisis was underwhelming by the end, very underwhelming. So he needs to find some fresh creative juice. Snyder continues to disappoint me. I think this Justice League is terrible. I read Last Night on Earth today and I almost fell asleep out of boredom. The second half of his Batman was boring. I probably would get rid of Scott Snyder, actually. Grant Morrison, fantastic. He's doing Green Lantern right now. I'd keep him on that title. If Grant Morrison wanted to come back and do Justice League, if you could pay him enough money, that's where I'd like Grant Morrison. I think Grant Morrison is an all-star. Rucker, I mean, this is, you know, Greg Rucker on anything, frankly. I've never read a Greg Rucker story that I haven't liked. There's just something about the guy. I would talk to Greg Rucker about what he wants to do, frankly. Dan Abnett, no idea. I've read a lot of good, solid 7.5 out of 10 material from him. I would probably have him, if you couldn't get Morrison, I'd probably put him on Justice League. I know he did a very good Legion run as well. So if Johns didn't want to do Legion, that's where I would throw Abnett. Who knows? I mean, the Vendetti, no idea. Matt Fraction, well, Matt Fraction is, I believe, doing that Jimmy Olsen book, which, yeah, I mean, you're struggling. Like, Matt Fraction's a very talented guy. I think he got overworked. I think he got burnt out, just my analysis. I liked a lot of what he did. I'd like to see him on more titles, like a Flash title, a Green Lantern title. Those kind of guys that aren't quite the Trinity, but very close. What I'm not seeing here is any women at all. Whoever's on Wonder Woman now needs to go. They need to get a proper Wonder Woman writer back again. James Tynion the IV, a lot of time for him. And if he was going to do normal Batman or Detective Comics, for sure. I think he has proven again and again and again how good he is. Williamson, I'm not really familiar with, so I can't comment. Orlando, that's Steve Orlando. Liked what I've read, actually. I think he did that Electric Warriors stuff. I'd like to see some of these guys, like, on a Hawkman title or a Hawkgirl title or a Dr. Fate title or Justice Society title. Like, don't always make a Batman and Superman. Like, that's a talented creative list. But some of the guys that are on that list are only doing very small things. Like, Morrison's only on Green Lantern. Rucker's just doing a Lois Lane title. Like, I don't think the money's there for them to stick around. Like, because otherwise you'd have Greg Rucker on a shitload of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, Greg Rucker has proven throughout his whole career of how good his quality is. So, you know, maybe he's working on a lot of creator-owned stuff. I don't know. Otherwise, DC are missing them. Like, they've got to up the stakes. Like, get these people in. Pay them well. You know what I mean? Pay them well, because it can pay off down the line. Yeah, so that's kind of my conception there. Now, Grant Morrison supposedly inspired Snyder and Capullo's Batman Last Night on Earth. I read the first issue. It's kind of a slow burn, sort of cool. Morrison might have inspired this, but it falls well short of Morrison's best work. This was another Scott Snyder, it felt like vanity project. The stuff with the clones I don't really appreciate. I don't like. As far as I'm concerned, yeah, this is looking boring. I don't know if I'll keep reading. It was overly long, and it was thin on story. And I think he does get inspired by Morrison, but he just falls a long way short of Morrison. You know, I mean, his Justice League is terrible. Grant Morrison did an amazing Justice League run of about 43 issues. Scott Snyder feels like it feels like it's gone on for 100 issues and nothing's happened. I think it's about issue 25 or 26, whatever it is. But you keep flashing back to it, and it's the same shit. Like, it's like Days of Our Lives, where the time moves so slowly. It's like, God, this sucks. Like, it's totally not interesting. And I'm not at all. And I'm one of the biggest Justice League fans I know. I love the old Justice League. I love Morrison's Justice League. I love Geoff Johns' Justice League. This Justice League about the fucking Batman who laughs, like, oh, I hate it. Like, if it had been a 5-issue series, good. But it's like 25 issues of just shit. And like, who cares? I just don't care. I don't buy into it. It's too boring. Scott Snyder, for me, his peak was high, and it was the beginning of his Batman run. I loved it. And then sort of that slowed down. The wheels kind of fell off, and I still feel he's falling short of the equation. I don't know. Interesting concepts in Snyder's work. He is a concept guy. Execution, I think, is quite poor. And maybe he's just overplaying his hand a bit. You know, maybe that he doesn't have much left in the tank. I don't know. It's just, again, just my analysis. Some of his work I really like, but I just feel that, like, where's the editorial kind of reins coming in a bit? Because this Justice League thing has just dragged on and on and on, and it becomes boring. And if you try to jump into it, you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. They're still sort of here. No. Hard pass on that.
Ain't it just like the need to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet? We'll sit here stranded, we're all doing our best to deny it. And Louise holds a handful of rain, tempting you to defy it. Lights flicker from the opposite loft. In this room, the heat pipes just cough. The country music station plays soft, but there's nothing, really nothing to turn off. Just Louise and her lover so entwined, and this visions of Johanna that conquer my mind. The empty lot where the ladies be. Blind man's bluff with the keychain. And the all night girls, the whisper of escapades out on the D train. We can hear the night watchman click his flashlight, ask himself if it's him or them, it's insane. Louise, she's alright, she's just near. She's delicate and seems like the mirror. But she just makes it all too concise and too clear that Johanna's not here. The ghost of electricity howls in the bones of her face. Of Johanna have not taken my place. Yeah, little boy lost, he takes himself so seriously. Of his misery, he likes to live dangerously. And when bringing her name up, he speaks of a farewell kiss to me. He sure got a lot of gall to be so useless and all. Muttering small talk at the wall while I'm in the hall. Oh, how can I explain? It's so hard to get on. And these visions of Johanna, they kept me up past the dawn. Inside the museums, infinity goes up on trial. Voices echo, this is what salvation must be like after a while. But Mona Lisa must have had the highway blues. You can tell by the way she smiles. Primitive wallflower freeze when the jelly-faced women all sneeze. Hear the one with the mustache say, "Geez, I can't find my knees." Oh, jewels and binoculars hang from the head of the mule. Visions of Johanna, they make it all seem so cruel. The peddler now speaks to the countess who's pretending to care for him. Name me someone that's not a parasite, and I'll go out and say a prayer for him. But like Louise always says, you can't look at much, can you, man, if she herself prepares for him. behind Madonna, she still has not showed. We see this empty cage now corrode, where her cape of the stage once it flowed. The fiddler, he now steps to the road. He writes, everything's been returned which was old. On the back of the fish truck that loads, while my conscience explodes. The harmonica's play, the skeleton keys and the ray. And these visions of Johanna are now all that remain.
Okay, this is an issue that I want to address. Basically, we all know Chuck Dixon, big friend of the show, and we have the Birds of Prey movie coming out. Chuck famously had a fantastic run on Birds of Prey for the miniseries into the ongoing. I think he did 46 issues of the ongoing. And I've spoken about this to Chuck as well, and in interviews, and he's also set the record straight. He's saying that Jordan Gorfinkel, who was the editor, was the one who pitched the series to Chuck and had to convince Chuck, as Chuck said to me, to actually write it, because he felt Chuck had the... He was the guy who could follow the emotional through line of the story. And as we see from his run, yes, he did. It's amongst my favourite Chuck Dixon stuff. I love that Birds of Prey run. I've brought it up myself when I've been chatting to him. Anyway, and the stinger is that Jordan Gorfinkel will not get credit as the creator of Birds of Prey, and neither is Chuck Dixon. It's an absolutely absurd situation that movies that will make hundreds of, like, even this movie bombed, it will still make over $100 million. So it'll make hundreds of millions of dollars, and potentially, you know, we've seen how much these films can make. I mean, Avengers Endgame cracked $2 billion. It just, and this has got Harley Quinn, who's hot as hell in terms of pop culture. So it's just another example of Warner's DC and slash any major corporate entity that is basically producing this kind of work screwing the creators out of a deal. And it's shameful. It's a disgrace. And the money they get, if they are credited as a creator, is apparently not high as well. I have a fundamental problem with how they're supposed to be so happy if they get a thank you, or allowed to cameo in a movie. Nothing speaks better than cold hard dollars, and I think it's on the studios to try to address this fact. Comic book creators who created things like Superman, like your Birds of Prey, like your Batmans, should not be living and dying in poverty. It's an absolute disgrace.
Sooner or later, one of us must know. Bob Dylan. Okay, picking up from where I set it down.
Okay, so the next item on the news agenda, Riddler, rumoured to be the next villain in the Batman movies that obviously are starring Edward. Is his name Edward Pattinson? Robert Pattinson. I was like, Edward. Oh, because he played. Anyway, let's not get into it. So Robert Pattinson is the Batman announced now. I'm cautiously optimistic. And I approach every pretty much incarnation of Batman with whoever they choose. I've always thought, well, go with it. You know, I don't think it's the hardest role in the world to play, personally. I hope he's a lot better than what I've seen in Twilight, and I have every reason to think he probably is, because those movies were poor. So I'm cautiously optimistic. Now, the next villain, is anything confirmed about these Matt Reeves movies? Is anything confirmed other than Rob Pattinson playing Batman? Do we have an Alfred? I don't know. If we do, tell me, internet. Tell me, senior listeners. Because you know me. I want to know. I want to be in on the fucking meeting. I'd love to be working in production on Batman. What are the villains? I thought we established that Catwoman was going to be in it.
I forget who else. Wasn't there rumors that Penguin was going to be in it, or perhaps that's more than a rumor, which would, I guess, make him the third villain, which I think is what the article I got this off said. But there's really nothing more to it than a rumor. So, to me, Riddler, Penguin, and Catwoman, that's very crowded for a first movie in a franchise. But we'll see. I mean, they've never... I mean, although I love so much of the Batman movies, they've never exactly done what I really want, which is more of a comic book feel. And maybe they never will. Obviously, the movies with Christian Bale were exceptional. And the first two... Well, the two Michael Keaton movies I really enjoyed. I don't know. I would like something a bit more comic-centric. And whether you can do that, I don't know. Because some people would have said, oh, well, George Clooney, Batman and Robin. Yeah, that really cheesy kind of like 60s style almost that was just awful. I hope they steer well away from that. And apparently this is going to be a noir movie, so that's interesting. Look, I'm sure they can come up with something. I look forward to it. Also, Warner Brothers are skipping Hall H at San Diego. Apparently after a few films not doing as well as expected, Stu was saying that Shazam underperformed. Actually, that's a good point from Stu. I'm sure if Stu said it, it's true, because he's a guy who loves a box office. Let's look up Shazam's numbers while we're here, because I think Stu was saying it did okay, but not stellar. And I mean, I thought as a movie it was 5.5 to 6, you know, out of 10. Nothing more, nothing less. Okay, so it looks like it's taken just under 140 domestically, foreign 223, 362 million worldwide on a production budget of 100 million. I mean, it turned a profit, but yeah, it didn't, you know, I mean, those numbers are quite decent, I think, but they're nothing exceptional, and neither was the movie, frankly, very forgettable. I've almost totally forgotten it. Some sad news. After 26 years, DC is rumored to be closing the Vertigo Comics imprint. There's quite an interesting article on Bleeding Cool about this. A key event apparently was several years ago when Alan Horn, a key executive there, questioned why so few Vertigo titles were being made into TV shows. Upon finding this was a result of the type of creator-owned deals they had, he sought to change the contract model retrospectively, which left many creators seeking alternate publishing houses with better deals that Vertigo was then prepared to offer, and Vertigo/DC. So, to me, this is just a huge failure on DC's part. And, like, why not offer the better deal? Like, surely you can match whatever deal Image or Dark Horse or Dynamite's doing. You've got far deeper pockets, like Warner's pockets. I just have such problems with the way creators are exploited and underpaid in the comic sphere. It frustrates me to no end. And I don't, if I was in corporate Warner's, like, it's not like they're getting this gigantic slice of the pie. Surely you can make the deal more attractive. I don't understand how they can't match whatever deal a fucking Image or a Dark Horse is giving them, really. Anyway, like, that's a discussion for another day. And Vertigo, like, I mean, let's face it, in the 90s and into the 2000s, like, the list of successes are huge under Karen Berger. They're immense. Sandman, Invisibles, Scalped. I mean, I'm just listing stuff at the very top of my head. You know, like 100 Bullets. Like, the list goes on and on and on. And they just sell well in... They must have sold very well in sort of like collected editions in bookstores and stuff. People like me... who came back to comics, we purchased all the stuff. Like, it's been bought so many times over, the model was working. But I guess across the street they got smarter. Image offers a very attractive deal. You retain the rights to the characters that you created. Good. Like, I'm like, good. That's an example of how it should be, as opposed to, like, this kind of, like, corporate take-it-all approach and then throw them a fucking couple of coin and wonder why they leave. And wonder why people are disenchanted. I am very disenchanted with that model. And I'm really surprised that they don't change that and up those deals, because it feels like they've got deep pockets if they really want to. Now, this is interesting. Adam the Computer was talking to me all about Doomsday Clock. Now, I read about the first 2 to 3 issues. I think I read the first three, and I was quite bored, frankly. It just wasn't popping to me. It wasn't... The art's beautiful. Gary Frankon art is fantastic. But it was just not what I had envisioned. But because of what Adam was saying, I went back and I got, because I get the DC copies, I went back and I read issues 9 and 10.
And let me tell you that it was such a different experience reading them than the early issues. This was all about the DC universe, the metaverse, some really interesting stuff about Superman and the different ways that Superman has, like, basically Dr. Manhattan's going in and out of sort of time, showing how Superman keeps getting reborn and made darker and et cetera, et cetera. Like, all this stuff. There's a really great line where he's in Superman's universe and he says, "I'm a man of inaction that is on a collision course with a man of action," i.e. being, you know, Superman in Action Comics. And there's just a lot of stuff going on in this comic that we seriously will read, Stu, and I will read the full edition when it comes out. I believe it's 12 issues. They've been quite slow to come out, but as I've said many times, Sandman was late all the time. And look at it now. You know what I mean? Like, I don't judge it. So if someone misses a week, I mean, I understand publishers care. As a reader, I don't particularly care. I want a good product. That's more important to me than it being on time every single day of the week. Now, I understand from a publisher's point of view, that's not ideal at all. But I don't know, when you're selling them as collected editions, like, you know, a couple of months after it's all finished, then it's all irrelevant and you're selling the collected edition. So that's what I always put my money on. Yeah, I don't want to really. There's the Legion of Superheroes has a very brief appearance, showing Superboy being in the future. A really good comic was Doomsday Clock. I'd give it like an 8 to an 8.5. I was thinking about it last night, long after I'd read it. That's very rare with comics for me, past the truly exceptional ones. Like, I tend to be read and forget. Yeah, Doomsday Clock 10. Like, honestly, if you haven't read any, I'd say wait till it's all collected and then read it all at once, because the start is slow. The start isn't that good, actually, to be honest. I'm not going to colour around the edges. Like, frankly, the start's quite boring, and he probably lost readers there. But it's a lot more interesting when he gets into the nitty-gritty of the DC Universe and the changes that have been made and, like, what caused New 52, i.e. Dr. Manhattan. And I just find all that stuff really interesting, and I really hope he can stick the landing and tie it all together perfectly. As I've said before, we're going to have Dion on the show soon, my mate Dion, and we'll do American Vampire Volume 1. That should be within the next 2 or 3 weeks. Stu's already been given instructions. Dion's got his copy, and I've got my copy. So we will have the little guy on for a full show. We'll do the news, etc. Weekly Comics! Also, one final thing, Marvel Comics 1000 is coming out. I'm sure Stu covered it. I still haven't seen his Time Machine shows, though, so neither has the audience. Look, this is a big thing that creators are working on a page, and it's for Marvel Comics 1000, all these different creators. I think it's really cool. Like, I'll wait till the issue comes out, but I think it's a really cool idea that they got these creators and said, you've got a page in this big comic. And a lot of the biggest names in the business from past and present assembled. Now, Weekly Comics, I want to kick this off with Deceased 2. This is an excellently paced Vision of Darkness. I fucking love this comic. I was talking to Jim at King's Comics about how much I dig it. Tom Taylor, you are a miracle worker when it comes to comics, Tom. I think Tom Taylor has knocked it out of the park time and time again. The art is also fantastic by Trevor Hessin. Hessin with a S-I-N-E. Look, to give people the pitch, basically a virus is being spread through, I think, technology, through smartphones and stuff, and it's infecting everyone. Like, so all the superheroes are getting infected. It kicks off with a scene with Aquaman, which is really cool. You see Batman trying to fight the virus inside Mr. Freeze's helmet. Damian, Jonathan, Kent, and obviously Superman are doing other things. Lois is there. There's just a lot going on in this comic. It's honestly one of the comics that it's as fun as anything I've read inside the last 5 years, and we're only 2 issues in. Like, I'm genuinely excited. This is kind of what I wish comics were more like. Take away some of the wisecracks and give me a really cool fucking scenario like this. And as Jim was saying, because it's in an alternate world, you know, you can kill Batman and Aquaman and stuff like that. So you feel there's something going on. I don't know. Maybe at some point regular comics are going to have to just embrace this model as well. So shit will have to change. I don't know. But all I know is this is a really good miniseries. And Tom Taylor, I followed this guy's work from Superior Iron Man, All New Wolverine. Like, I know he's done Injustice, which we mentioned earlier in the show. I haven't read a ton of that, but there's just something I trust with his writing style. It just grips me. He's an Aussie as well, so shout out to Tom. I'm giving this an 8.5 out of 10. The next comic is Black Cat 1. Now, look, I love Black Cat. Okay, I've got a figure of her where she looks fantastic and her boobs are popping out and all that. Like, I love Black Cat. Like her as a character, I think she's a lot of fun. This comic is maybe a little bit predictable, but it's enjoyable. So it's enjoyable if a little predictable, like talking about being the cat all the time. You know, a very Catwoman thing to do as well. It's maybe a little laboured, but then again, it's also fun and there's a really good scene at the end where there's like two mini stories, one with her cats and then one with this other guy who taught her all her tricks. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a very fun read. I gave it 7.5 out of 10. I think it's rare, but this comic feels like it's taking too much time to get where it should be going. As in, I felt like there were too many pages. This is such an odd thing for me to say because generally I feel like with these comics, nothing happens. I felt on this one, it was weird. Like it was almost padded a bit. Like they were deliberately stretching it out, is what I'm trying to say. And in one issue, I don't know, it kind of worked. I gave it 7.5 out of 10. I probably could be argued to an 8. It's a good comic. And I love, if you like Black Cat like I do, this was enjoyable. And I preferred it to how she's been in Spider-Man, where she was a flat out villain. This is the kind of Black Cat persona I like. The art I wasn't super hot on. But nonetheless, it is very professionally done. It is a good comic, and apparently it's an ongoing. We'll see how long that lasts with Black Cat. I enjoyed it. Then we had Star Wars: The Age of the Rebellion, Luke Skywalker. I only gave this a 6 out of 10, and I have enjoyed these very much. I thought this one was not as interesting, and I could only give it a 6. I had interesting but inessential, which sort of sums up how I feel about this comic. It's not terrible. It's not great, but it's also not terrible. 6.5 out of 10. Greg Pak, I think he's done better work on other Star Wars titles than this one, personally. Interesting idea, though, to have what I imagine must have been a Luke post-Empire, because he was dressed in a black outfit. There were some cool moments in it. Some of the pacing I thought was a little weird. Like, it would cut from scene to scene with no real sort of like, I don't know what you call it, but like transition move. And I don't know, it just didn't quite get me. Then we had my comic of the week. And that's in a week with Deceased 2. So look, Savage Avengers 2, magnificent. Conan, Wolverine, Mike Diodato art. I mean, my God, this guy knows how to draw Wolverine. Go put him on a fucking solo Wolverine title. Let's make this fucking happen. I'm so sick of asking for it. And I did ask Sebi Sabowski. I mean, this guy just gets Wolverine. He's got the tan suit. Great Conan. We see the mix with Venom coming out, the alien. Oh, there was just so much stuff that I dug in this comic. I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. And this and Deceased 2 are my comics of the week. I really think they're really fantastic comics. And look, one of them comes from DC, one comes from Marvel. You're not talking to a guy with huge preferences on either side. Like, two really strong comics this week. I'm picking up Savage Avengers in hardcover. I hope this title keeps going. I absolutely love it. And we've already just... Last Night on Earth, overly long and dull. I wasn't a big fan. And we've discussed Doomsday Clock 9 and 10. Look, so that covers the weekly comics. Now, I'm going to do a little segment now on the original Clone Saga, okay? Because this is done by Jerry Conway. I want to give readers kind of the pitch. I'd never read it myself. Obviously, we had the 90s Clone Saga, which went for too many years and confused readers after a fairly good start. I never really read it. I wasn't reading Spider-Man at the time because it felt like the titles were in chaos, and it was just easier to stay away at the time. I still think it's almost unbelievable they tried to reboot Peter Parker with a clone, like, and really do that. I almost can't believe they thought that was a good idea. But anyway, the original Clone Saga harkens back to the 70s, where basically Gwen Stacy, who died, you know, a couple of years previously, falling off the bridge, and then when Spider-Man caught her and her neck snaps, basically she comes back into Peter's life. It's sort of underplayed by other people. Like, Peter has a real problem with it, okay, and he's struggling. At the same time, he's falling more in love with Mary Jane and, you know, post Gwen Stacy dying, and hence it throws a real crimp into their relationship. Other people seem to have a lot less of a problem with Gwen Stacy suddenly appearing than Peter, which is odd in the comic. There's a lot of stuff to enjoy, and one thing I really loved is the interconnectivity of the Marvel Universe back then. Literally, adventures referenced that happen off the page, but take place in another Marvel book. Now, I know that this still happens, but it happens a lot more here. You really do feel like the Marvel Universe is a living, breathing place. And how old was the Marvel Universe at this point? Like, what, 13, 14 years? Something around those lines. Like, not too much more than that, and probably not too much less than that. Jerry Conway is writing. The soap opera feel is high, but I must admit, I dove back into this reminding me of why I like Spider-Man so much. And this is one that I think kind of like, it is your dad's Spider-Man or your granddad's Spider-Man, but it still works. Spider-Man is excellent. I find it a lot more intriguing than Spider-Man these days. That could just be me getting older and just growing a bit tired of sort of some of the stuff they do with Spider-Man. But I thought it was really good. I reached out to Jerry Conway on Twitter and told him we were going to talk about this. Now, we're going to do a much more thorough explanation of it next show. But there was a note early on in the issue, 146, that this marked 3 years of Jerry Conway on the title. I think he's doing a great job. Scorpion is a cool villain. The Jackal, which, spoilers, kids, is shown to be Professor Warren, is flat out bizarre, the Jackal. I really only know the Jackal because he was in, like, the Punisher's first appearance, I think. And, he's just a bizarre character. And I'm really looking forward to it in the second half of the series, where Stu and I will talk more about the payoffs. This was a lot of setup. Some of the layouts referencing Gwen are really cool. There's a page 192, the sequence with Gwen in the mirrors running towards Spidey. Very cool. How many times am I going to hold you and feel you slipping away forever? Ross Andru, A-N-D-R-U, is an incredible artist. This Spider-Man, it is honestly the kind of Spider-Man I'd love to have on my walls. It's incredible. I enjoyed this more than I thought I would, because sometimes when you read the older comics, you are a bit let down. I thought this was fascinating. You're touching the true source material of what Spider-Man is, really. And Spidey feels alive in these pages. I'd never read it before this show. I'd heard of it, but I'd never read it. And I'm interested to see what Stu thinks. I found it was a real page-turner, personally. There's a lot to like in this. And so much of it that's so key is he has the soap opera elements, incredible art, and it just kind of keeps flowing. So I read, even though it was like 496 pages, I read half of it pretty quickly because I was just flicking through pages. And if it doesn't feel like I've got anything deep to say, what I'm telling you is it's just a really compelling character and a character arc. It's really quite, it's really professional. It feels tight. You still feel like he's ducking and weaving through the Marvel Universe, but it's just a Spidey story that's really good. All the players that are there that, you know, J. Jonah Jameson, Robbie, you know, et cetera, obviously Mary Jane, really interesting moments with her because they're falling more in love, but then Gwen Stacy comes along. I dug it. I give it an 8 out of 10, easily. Probably an 8.5, actually. 8.5, yeah. And I would anticipate the second half with all the payoffs is even going to be better. I got right up to the end part where the professor is revealed to, or the Jackal is revealed to be the professor, which I knew, actually, his name, but it sort of still got me because this is where they reveal it, obviously, whereas in later issues, it's known. It's an 8.5 out of 10. It's a hell of a lot of fun. If you like Spidey, yeah, grab it. Like, I mean, I grabbed it on Amazon, Kindle sale or something, and I've got it on my iPad, and I definitely recommend it. We're going to do on the show at some point, we'll touch the 90s Spidey. Why not? The 90s Clone Saga. Why not? We like to challenge ourselves on the show. But because I know the end of this, which is interesting. There's an interesting end of this comic, which is where the 90s guys picked it up, the thread up from. And it is interesting. Concept, which we'll discuss later next show.
Just to close the circle on the Bob Dylan fandom,
that has taken place this show in honor of the 14-CD release of the 1975 Rolling Thunder Review. I wanted to leave you with some words from Bob Dylan himself, which were, he wrote in his autobiography, the first volume, Chronicles, an amazing book that I recommend everyone picks up. When I finished reading it, I actually almost felt like I got everything I could possibly get from a book. He talks about, it's basically snapshots of his life, like from the 80s back to the very early days of his career, a lot of it focuses on. It's really interesting and a real insight into the man. But he talks about leaving behind their first phase of his career as a folk singer in New York City. And I'm just going to quote from here. This is the end of the book. The folk music scene had been like a paradise that I had to leave, like Adam had to leave the garden. It was just too perfect. In a few years' time, a shitstorm would be unleashed. Things would begin to burn. Bras, draft cards, American flags, bridges too. Everybody would be dreaming of getting it on. The national psyche would change, and in a lot of ways it would resemble the Night of the Living Dead. The road out would be treacherous, and I didn't know where it would lead, but I followed it anyway. It was a strange world ahead that would unfold, a thunderhead of a world with jagged lightning edges. Many got it wrong, and never did get it right. I went straight into it. It was wide open. One thing for sure, not only was it not run by God, but it wasn't run by the devil either. I love those words. I love that passage, the passage about Night of the Living Dead and the future that we idealize. You know, and at the same time, there was an incredible violent undercurrent to it all. It's an amazing book about an amazing time, and I still think has some truth in it for today's generations.
There must be some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine. Come and dig my earth. None will level. But a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us start talking falsely now. The hour's getting late. Wildcat did growl. Two riders
Now, look, I honestly hope that I've given you guys enough. I feel bad for you because it's been kind of another solo album, and the material I have is, it's there, but it doesn't feel like it's like 2-3 hours worth. I'm sorry for that. I've tried to entertain as much as possible. Follow us on the Facebook page, Signal of Doom. Any questions that you have or recommendations you would like to have for the show, email signalofdoom@gmail.com or message the Facebook page as well. You can do that. I'm on Facebook. You can do that as well. What else? Follow us on Twitter at redlantern2051 is my Twitter handle. There's an at Signal of Doom Twitter handle as well. So if you want to follow those, feel free. I put all the shows up. What else? Stu back next week. I'll be here. We're doing Dark Phoenix. That's right. We'll also have a Dark Phoenix review, like quite an in-depth review. If I see Aladdin in that time span, I'll also give it a review. Other than that, guys, like, you know, and girls, like, look, enjoy yourselves. Go check out that Bob Dylan. You know, have a great week. I love you very much. And I will catch you next time.